The Institute for the Humanities at Salado presents Understanding Vietnam. This is code 3B-48-82, a continuation of the discussion on the Second Indochina War, Vietnam Reconsidered.
Therefore, from Giap's point of view, he, although he maybe didn't realize the next day, he achieved his objective. Now, technically, there is no question, it's not arguable that he suffered extremely serious military defeat. I mean, they don't argue that. Neither side argues that. That's an accepted, that's a given.
Well, I'm not sure if it's a given. I've just heard you say that, but I'm not sure that's...
Well, all right, okay, there are 40,000 people killed, mainly Viet Cong. The Viet Cong infrastructure was essentially wiped out. These are facts that are not disputed. I would say that's a military defeat. Now, if you want to look at military by embracing the definition, you know, of the JCS, include, which is quite proper, I think, to do, including the psychological and other factors, then in an overall sense, they won. I think I said also it was a technical military defeat for them. So if you want to embrace a broader meaning of strategy, it's not here. There's no question that they won it from that point of view.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm Byron Stone. I'm a physician from San Antonio. I'm very interested in the results of the survey you did. I want to know if similar surveys have been done following other wars with similar results. And then I want you to answer the question, do you feel that if General Westmoreland had approached the war with different objectives, a more favorable or more expeditious result could have been obtained?
On the survey first, I think that there has none other been done like that. There was an attempt made to do it sometime after World War II on some World War II generals, but for some reason it didn't work out. I don't know why. This was an idea of my own to do this, and I did it. I executed it myself with a graduate student assistant and without any other outside support. So it was a non-governmental thing, which I simply did on my own, and that's the basis of this book called The War Managers. Now out of print, I'm not trying to plug it right. which you might want to glance at. Incidentally, I'll get to Westmoreland's objectives in a minute. This is an interesting copy of the book I meant to mention to you earlier, but I ran out of time. When this book first came out, I appeared on Good Morning America, and since I'm relatively unknown, they wanted to get somebody on there who was a little bit better known, so I was, inflicted is not the word. General Westmoreland was invited on the program with me. He managed to take up 7 out of the 10 minutes, but that's that's okay. On the way to the airport, I said to him, General Westmoreland, you've been critiquing my book this morning. It's impossible that you could have read it, because I think I have the only copies out in my bag. Would you like a copy? I said, yes. So I gave him this copy. For several days thereafter, I received telephone calls from him. Why did I say this or why did I say that? Fortunately, on about the fourth day, I had to go drive over to Maine to close a home I own there on the coast, which doesn't have a telephone. So that broke the dialogue. However, about a month later, there appeared in the mail this copy of the book without covers. He saves covers, I think. And in here, in his handwriting, you can examine this if you wish, are comments on almost every page, either taking me to task or some imaginary general who, of course, I didn't give the names in here. I have the Rosetta Stone at home, but I think that will depart with me when I check out of the net, so they will remain permanently anonymous. In terms of Westmoreland's objectives, could they have been different? Westmoreland considered, he says, at times thinking about resigning in a sense, not, you know, in a formal sense, but saying he just couldn't handle it or something of that nature. So he could have maybe forced it from that point of view. I doubt it, given the political constraints. The main military critique of Westmoreland is the one that Dr. Rostow, as a matter of fact, alluded to earlier. If you go through the generals who constructively write on how Westmoreland could have changed the fighting of the war, rather than fighting a search and destroy all over South Vietnam, should have insisted on the employment of the American military along the north, cutting into Laos, perhaps over the border, as sort of an action to prevent the resupply down, and then at the same time tried to build up the people behind. That's the main critique. I would say if there's any one critique that's of his objectives that he should have tried to change, that's it. Does that answer the question, sort of? Yeah. He doesn't answer any more than that in his book.
I'm Warren Townsend. I'm a psychotherapist from Killeen. I see a lot of military families. I was asking, the Army's attitude in terms of the resupply of troops through an individual rotation rather than larger groups coming and leaving by themselves, and the psychological effect this had on the individual serviceman, did that policy reflect in any way the military's viewpoint about this particular war and how it wished to approach it?
It was a decision of General Westmoreland's made early on, both to handle it that way and to curtail the length of tour, with the appreciation, I think, that using in a sense the Korean analogy again, viewing that it would be a relatively long war and that people should not be forced to pay the burden of, you know, staying for long terms. A unit rotation kind of thing might have brought. Obviously, it's inefficient. It's highly inefficient. Only a country with a huge fleet of jets could move individuals back and forth into the battle zone. And obviously, you have 12 different units in the course of a year. You have a unit and a group of people go home the next month and so forth. So there's nothing to be said for it except from a point of view of morale. That people would not want to individually be inflicted with that. Now, what impact it had on total morale by sort of less efficient units, that only became evident later on. Now, the first units that were fielded in Vietnam in 1965, the 1st CAV, for example, probably is one of the best examples, but also others, were the finest military units the United States ever put in the field at the outset of a war. There was nothing ever close. I hate to admit that about World War II, but there was nothing close. But by the time the war ended, this very system that you're talking about, plus problems of support at home, which General Shoemaker alluded to, had taken their toll, and the units were very ineffective. I think he thought he had no choice but to do it that way, recognizing its inadequacies.
My name is Harry Middleton. I'm from the LBJ Library.
Sir.
How are you? In your opinion, was a military victory for the U.S. forces even possible in Vietnam? And if so, what might the objective have been that was given to General Westmoreland that would have been accomplished through a military victory, and how could it have been accomplished?
I don't think it was possible given the constraints that we fought under in terms of a military victory as you mean it. I think if the programs had been changed after 73, that the South Vietnamese conceivably might have ended up with a stalemate of some kind. In terms of military victory, I don't really see how you can win a victory, whatever that means in this sort of thing, without going to where the person is, which in this case is in North Vietnam and certainly in the jungle sanctuaries. And for political reason, that wasn't deemed to be possible. So I would answer your question and say no, it was not possible. No one knew that in advance, but I would say in retrospect, a victory was not possible without changing the rules of the game. And the rules of the game mean going where the enemy is and destroying them, his armies.
Should the rules of the game been changed? That's all I'd like to know. Should they have been changed?
Well, maybe modified a little bit, I think, if you're going to make... Either you should not have made that commitment of resources. Now, that was not a given. All options were open in January 1st, 1965. All options. Getting out, including. No option was open in July 1965. A critical period of the spring of 1965. After that, it was very difficult to change the rules. Before that, it was still possible. Obviously, in retrospect, yes, they should have been.
Should have gone on, and if they wanted to bomb, let them bomb. Go after the enemy. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think that's what I'm saying, no. I would have taken the other course, but that I don't think I would have committed the troops. But that's a separate thing. If you want to commit to victory, you see, I don't think bombing does it. You know, I mean, I'm not infatuated with bombing the North or bombing anything else. When I said you have to go after the enemy, I don't mean by bombs, I mean by people.
Well,
I mean, I think it's decided.
Should we have gone after them with people? That's what I'm
no.
Then you say we should have gotten out.
Yes. I think if you were going to fight it, you should have at least gone into a shallow thing in North Vietnam. Otherwise, you weren't fighting a war, yeah, in retrospect. Right? Yeah.
My name is Gretchen Sabin, and I'm from Austin. And it seems to be that this whole war is based on American characteristic of acting without thinking and feeling more comfortable with action than reflection or information gathering. And it seems to be a war that, it was stated, was based on false assumptions. So how can you have clear objectives when you're basing it on false assumptions? And how can winning make any difference? And is there any way that we can put billions of dollars into information gathering and also be clear about having an information gathering which is objective and detached from the political, and yet the political will pay attention to the information that is gathered? And so I really...
I think your third question is the key one. I of course, we haven't dwelt on this, and this is not particularly my forte, but I have read the Pentagon Papers and at least one version of them, the Gravel edition, and it's quite clear to me, and I of course would defer to my colleague Dr. Rostow on this, that the information from the point of view of the strategic information, point of view of the CIA, wasn't bad. I think the CIA came to some pretty damn good conclusions, and my impression of what I read in the Pentagon Papers, and again, the Pentagon Papers are just that, they're selected papers, they're not the whole thing, was that you can't beat these guys. I think they said it very clearly. But the CIA doesn't make policy, and policymakers have to take the CIA along with other things into consideration when making a decision. I don't think the information was that bad. I think if you're going to fault something, you have to fault the decision-making process or individuals, if you wish. I mean, you may, I'm saying. But I don't think the information was really that bad. I think at times it was askewed. I think, for instance, there's a sort of an interesting dialogue that Walt opened up there about the warning on Tet 68. I mean, I didn't get into all aspects of Tet 68, obviously, in the time available, but there was a warning that there was an offensive coming. There were signs, but nobody read them on the scope and magnitude that happened. So that was where the difference came. In other words, could that information have been more perfect? I don't think so. Could the interpretation of it have been more perfect? I think so. I think so. I think the strategic information was also pretty good. If you read the Pentagon Papers, you get some revelations about that. Walt, did you want to comment on that at all?
The microphone there for Mr. Jalen. Bill, go ahead.
Well, I think the CIA is making a good value. I think that on Tet, the only surprise was they went into all of those hamlets and provincial capitals, which produced the reason that we were surprised was that it was
such a disaster. As you point out, the VC down to this day was died in Tet, and the North Vietnamese took over. That's why they have a carpetbagger operation in the South. There are no South Vietnamese communists left, really, and there weren't. Mm-hmm. On the question of whether the CIA said these guys couldn't be beat, I think that they said that they would be stubborn and protracted. When we asked them, would there be a larger war if we cut the supply lines in Laos, or went as far north into North Vietnam as Vinh and held that as hostage for their getting out, they quite accurately, in my judgment, said that neither the Chinese nor the Soviets would come into it if we went in that much.
Neither of them.
Neither would come in. Well, the Chinese were off on the Cultural Revolution, really having a civil war at that time, and the Russians would not have did not regard this as a major place, nor did they have the capacity to intervene. But there never was an argument, I know, that if you cut the supply lines in Laos and a bit over the DMZ, but it was mainly through Laos, that the movement in the South could survive.
I have time for one more. I think, Phil, you had your hand up.
Yeah. I have one question.
General, I just wanted to develop a little on Harry Middleton's questions about the...
Will you identify yourself?
Phil Jalin with the Washington Post, or a syndicated column, about whether we could have won. What you're saying, I take it, is that we could not have won militarily under the constraints. There are other ways of defining victory, however.
Oh, sure.
As you all remember, Senator Aiken said, let's just declare it.
I never considered that profound.
No,
I know George Aiken. Yeah.
But it has a certain germ of wisdom to it. But there was another alternative, and that was that you define it in terms of a diplomatic settlement, which might include a coalition government, which might meet the terms that Senator Muskie then advanced, which I thought were very subtle and rather good, in which he said that we will never make peace out here until both sides agree simultaneously that they have a better chance of gaining at the bargaining table what they want than they have on the battlefield, but until both sides are prepared to risk losing everything that they were trying to gain on the battlefield in the course of negotiations. Which brings up that question, which was a very big question at the time of a coalition government, and whether we should have taken the risk of shared power between the two forces in a stalemated situation, and whether that might not have been an honorable conclusion.
What year are you talking about now? I know, what?
Well, let's see, 67, 68. Into the Nixon years, too.
Well, do you think that the North Vietnamese would have accepted a coalition?
I have no idea, because I think the idea was throttled in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Who wants to ask a question? Should we turn on it?
I have one question.
You want to make no distinction?
Well, this be the last one, then.
Yeah. All right. I want to address just one very narrow aspect of... I'm sorry. My name is Bo Byers. I'm with the Houston Chronicle in Austin, Texas. I want to address one rather narrow aspect of the discussion here, but I think it's relatively important. It relates to a statement that the general made about the role of the press, in which I gather that he was saying it's inevitable that you have to expect the press to be there reporting on the war, and particularly the graphic effect of television. I also want to relate this to a statement by Walt Rostow, and I believe it's consistent with prior statements, in which he frequently raises a question of the media's misinterpretation of the war.
I think he said it at Tet 68, didn't he? That's what he said today, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but I think that he is consistent in saying that the press generally throughout misinterpreted what was happening. And I do not say this defensively, but I agree with the statements that have been made repeatedly by the general and others that to win a war, you have to have a unified national purpose and will, which we certainly had in World War I, I think. World War II definitely did not have, in my opinion, in Korea or Vietnam. Now that brings me to, I suppose, a point and a question. I think the media does have an influence on what happens because they affect people's opinions. But I do have a question whether or not the press should be accused of misinterpretation when, as Mr. Rostow said, neither the public nor the press, which tries to represent the public, is given the facts. And I would raise the question, therefore, in light of the Falklands experience, General, do you think we could satisfactorily impose totalitarian constraint on the press in the event of some future conflict?
Absolutely not. I thought I was quite clear on that. I thought I said that the media, which includes the press, is a given, and we have to accept it, and we have to plan accordingly. It's absolutely out of the question. I don't think I said that the press portrayed things inaccurately. I never made that statement, no. What I said is this is a given in making your planning. If you can't sustain the course, with this given, then you can't play the game. We just got to take it into account, like you take into account how many forces you have, how many resources, whether it's worth it on a cost benefit, and this sort of thing. I guess that the TET 68, which I think is all that he mentioned, that Dr. Rostow mentioned today, I think that in TET 68 there is, of course, this book written by one of your own number, Peter Braestrup, called Big Story, in which he has two big volumes, one with footnotes and one with text, which he takes the press to account for their interpretation of TET 1968. Do you consider, let me ask you the question, do you consider that a valid critique on Braestrup's part, or have you read it?
I haven't read it. I'm familiar with it. Mm-hmm. I think it's a valid critique, but again, I would come back to the point that he had to rely, I think, as the media always has, on access to the information, which I believe you indicated was not being made available to the public by President Johnson, that invariably there is a wall erected between the media and the facts.
Okay. Well.
But none of that reading, I was instructed to read the White House to talk. But my point was not that anything was withheld, nothing was really withheld in that war. And it never got to the public. And only the President and State of the Union message could have galvanized the public to expect this happen.
In concluding this morning, I'd like to just simply say that John Culkin, one of Marshall McLuhan's disciples and students, suggested the best way to win the war would for our B-52s not to drop bombs, but to drop television sets in North Vietnam. So with that kind of relief of this pain, please go to your appropriate number and for lunch.
That concludes this session. Thank you.